Thank you, Professor Raymond Sauter, for a very interesting and detailed presentation, I'm sure that you'd agree with. There will be time later on this afternoon where we'll be able to give some time for you to engage in questions and answers with our second and first and third speakers this afternoon. For those of you that came in perhaps a bit later whilst the presentation was taking place, there are indeed PowerPoint printed copies of the PowerPoint presentation the Professor has just presented to us at the back of the room, where tea and coffee will be served shortly. I'd now like to introduce our second speaker for the afternoon, Mr. Alan Don. If I direct you to your speaker profiles, you will see that Alan is an experienced and distinguished civil servant and in health-related matters. Recently, within the last couple of years, in 2005, he led the team that produced the government's white paper, Our Health, Our Care, Our Say, and the Your Health, Your Care, Your Say listening exercise that sets out strategic visions for health and social care activities. From the 1st of October 2007, he was appointed as interim chief executive of the HFEA, whilst Angela McNab is on 6 months secondment to the Department of Health. So we're very pleased to have him with us this afternoon. He will be having to leave due to other engagements this evening straight after his presentation, so I will return for a short question and answer session with just Alan, and then we'll have a tea and coffee break. So I would like to introduce Alan Don this afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you? Well, good, good. I'm Alan Doran. I am a bureaucrat from the Department of Health. For 5 weeks now, I've been at the HFEA, so nothing else to learn, really. That's why I came here. Let me start with a story about Gandhi. When he was really famous, and quite a public figure, he was landing one day at an international airport, and he was coming down the steps in the plane. There was a big throng of journalists, people wanting to meet the great man. And they were crowding around him, and he was making his way slowly through them. One particularly insistent and impetuous journalist stuck a microphone under his nose and said, "Mr. Gandhi," he said. And the great man looked at him and he said, "Mr. Gandhi, what do you think of Western civilization?" And Gandhi looked at him softly and said, "It would be a good idea." So my talk is about balancing trust with progress, and it would, wouldn't it? Be a good idea if the HFEA can do that. And I think we make a first stab at it. What I want to talk to you about is, can you hear me without this? Is why I think the UK's approach and the HFEA, the United Kingdom rejoices in having four countries, but and some public bodies relate only to England, some only to Scotland, some to Wales, some to... We relate to the whole of the United Kingdom. So I'm talking about why the United Kingdom's approach, I think, works, but it works for us here in the United Kingdom. We're not saying it will necessarily work for everybody else, because they have different circumstances and different cultures. It's generally thought internationally that the UK has been fortunate to have had an early debate on assisted reproduction and embryo research. I'm sure you all know that the debate was carried out by Baroness Warnock, an eminent ethicist who chaired the Warnock Committee in the 1980s, and she enunciated the basic principle, which is that the British people should rely on us upon those who make decisions if those who make them balance the interests of patients and wider society with the desires and capabilities of the professionals who offer treatment and research. So the fundamental proposition of arriving at a balance of those different views and perspectives is what Warnock was about. And I think few people would disagree with the principle. What matters for my organisation, for the HFEA, is how well we put it into practice. The good thing about Western civilization is it would be a good idea, isn't it? And putting that Warnock principle into practice is the good idea that we aspire to. We're about to see change in our legislation. Today's quite a day for us. In the Queen's speech, the government has indicated they're going to introduce a new bill. So not only will we have a lot of work to do, which will make you feel sorry for us, but there's going to be a great deal of public interest in a whole number of areas that we're about to talk about this afternoon and this evening. You can take it from me that this area is going to be a topic of real robust discussion and debate over the next 5 to 6 months. What we won't be doing, I'm sure, is moving away from the key one of the principle. What we will be debating is how we apply it in practice. I was very interested in what Christoph had to say. I think there is commonality of interest across Europe. We've already got a European Tissues and Cells Directive, which I shall come back to, in place. And the point about that is it gives us assurance for patients and professionals that at bottom, the best and safest practice in assisted reproductive technology and in embryo research can take place inside the EU within a common framework. The debate is how far the framework should go to constrain or impose a particular approach. And that's one of the things I want to talk to you about. We've got standards for screening sperm donors and the switch from payment to compensation for donors, which ensures that men and women don't feel coerced into donating, is really important. And the directive eases the process for transferring samples between licensed clinics. So it has practical advantages. We also have a European Assisted Conception Consortium, which I'll come back to, which tries to ensure that those who are interested in this work across Europe keep in touch with each other informally and can work together. So the collaboration that we have that's developing within the EU means reassurance for patients and professionals about core standards. The point I want to make is that working together needs to be based on respect for each other's different cultural and social perspectives. Harmonisation can mean many different things. It does not mean that one size fits all. That's because I think the area that we work in, fertilisation and embryology, is one of those things that goes to the heart of what a country's sense of itself is. It's hard. I've known about the HFPA from a slight distance, and I've been in it now for 5 to 6 weeks, and it's hard to overstate the emotional charge that can attach to some of the issues that we become involved in. It really is. So what is it that we do in the UK? I think firstly, what we try to do is have the same standards for both private and publicly funded clinics. Again, the distinction between private and public means different things in different countries. In the UK, it has a particular resonance, as you all know. The NHS carries with it a real force of acknowledgement with the UK public. And there's a strong sense about attachment to the NHS and service at point of need, not dependent upon ability to pay. Quite different to some other countries that I shall mention. So we have the same standards, and the standards that are expressed through our code of practice are followed by clinics, and patients can access that code of practice online. So they know what standard will apply when they go to a clinic. So if they go to a clinic in London or in Glasgow or anywhere else, they know what the broad clinical and scientific standards are. And we produce those. We don't produce them on our own. What we do to make sure that those standards reflect best practice is we work in collaboration with professional bodies and those in the sector to produce the code of practice. It's a collaborative effort. It isn't top-down. It has an authority, but it is done in collaboration with people who work in the sector and with the professional bodies. And the second point I want to make is how closely we actually work with the clinics and the centres themselves. We are in contact with them on a regular basis. It's proportionate. They are always so happy to see us. They're always so happy to fill in our forms. They lose few opportunities to tell us. What we try to do is be proportionate and measured and reasonable, but we work with them. We don't impose on them where we can avoid. We work with them to develop a joint approach. Because clinics and centres know where they're at, and we will at some point inspect them once a year or whenever, they know where they're at, and they work with us to set standards for themselves, because we reflect them in the code of practice. So there's a pull, a magnetic pull, from our work with the centres. They know we're going to be looking at the standards that they're capable of. They want to show to us, well, we're doing this already. So there's a sense of a drive towards continuous improvement by working with them in this way, rather than being seen to work outside or against them. That's what we try to do. If you take PGD, one of the things for our guests from elsewhere, one of the things this country rejoices in is TLAs, three-letter acronyms. The NHS is a three-letter acronym. There's another one, which I've learned only in the past few weeks, of PGD, which is, I better get this right because Gemma's here, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. All right? And we, in the HFEA, had to arrive at a policy decision on this a few months ago. Luckily for them, I wasn't there. I'll come back in a moment when we're done with PGD, how we go about it generally. But we already had, in existence, policy on one area of Huntington's disease, where we had an established policy, and what we needed to address was the policy on some types of trestle. Just lost my face. Remind me, Gemma, where is it? I apologise. Yes. So we had an existing policy on Huntington's disease. And the characteristics of the policy of Huntington's disease are that its penetrance is almost 100%. So if you've got the gene, you're going to get the condition. Yes? It can develop early in life. Symptoms are serious. Treatment options are limited. And life expectancy is also limited. So we had a policy on PGD that we thought balanced trust with progress for Huntington's disease. Yes? What we had to consider was, for some types of inherited breast cancer, was the same policy the right one? And for inherited breast cancer, the penetrance isn't almost 100%, it's 50 to 80%. So you could, the scientists, the technicians, could be screening out embryos which never would develop the cancer. This type of cancer develops later in life, usually in middle age. And there are treatment options available. People do survive breast cancer. So there's what you can't do, what we couldn't do, to transfer lock, stock and barrel, an existing policy for one condition to this one. So what did we do? We went and asked people. We gathered the evidence as best we could. One thing to say about evidence, one of the lessons I learned from our white paper work, is people say, well, you must have evidence-based medicine. And that's correct. But my experience is, evidence is never comprehensive. It never covers everything that you want. It isn't. And secondly, and even more importantly, when you look at the evidence, does it all always point in the same direction? No. Sometimes there's evidence to support some things, but not all of them. Sometimes it's mixed. For my white paper, we were looking at, does it make sense to move some services out of hospital? What we had was evidence where it worked in some cases and not in others. So what we did in the HFEA with regard to PGD, what we do is we seek expert advice. We gather it together. But we also, as well as the experts, because if you remember what Baroness Warner had to say in her report, it isn't just a matter for the specialists or the experts or the technicians, though they are a very legitimate constituency. What do the patients think? And what do the general public think? And we went to find out. Again, we may not have done it perfectly, but what we did, we published an online discussion paper, we held open public meetings for debate, we gave as many people as we could the chance to comment. And then we put the results of that process to our authority and said, this is what we know about the evidence, the views, the science, the clinical perspectives about this question. How do you think we should develop our policy in looking at this new disease as opposed to the old one? That's what we did. And that enabled us to arrive at a decision. We set a policy which in certain circumstances allowed PGD. You, Christoph, I was fascinated by your talk. You did use the word liberal. And you had us over here proudly at one end of the spectrum. I don't think we see ourselves as liberal in the sense of free or too easy in the sense of not really caring. We're not liberal in that sense, because every single case, every single application has to be looked at on its merits. There's no general policy that you can go away and do it. And there's no presumption, even where you have a disease category where we have a policy, but a specific proposal to use it will be allowed. Now, I know you were using liberal in a different sense, but we, again, it's about a balance, isn't it? That what you are trying to strike in allowing science and clinical practice to move forward and balancing that against the very strongly held and nuanced views of what people think society should be about. And so that concept of trust in our title, about balancing trust with progress, the trust is that we will respect, I agree with what you said about reflecting all points of view. There are people, 20% of people, don't think IVF should be undertaken. But it is. And what we have to do as a public body is try to respect that point of view without, it's the point about the tyranny of the majority, but also the tyranny of the minority. How do you manage the two? You try to capture and reflect the different points of view. At least the most recent Mori data we have on IVF says that only 50%, only one in two people think it's of unquestioned value. Now, let me tell you, because I'm sure many of you have, if you talk to the people who can't have children other than through IVF, they think IVF has a value beyond stating. They really do. And again, what we in the HFEA try to do is balance that strength of view. What is more... What would cause you to hold your breath more than knowing that you are involved in something that leads to the start of a life? Even for me as a bureaucrat, that's what we're trying to do. And people feel it very, very strongly on all sides of the spectrum. So what the HFEA attempts to do, we might not do it perfectly, is strike that balance of public opinion, the intense emotional desire of the patients to have children, with the equally powerful force of scientific advance. There are things going on now that my parents wouldn't have thought possible. I'm as old as I look. Some of the science is just amazing. And what the HFEA does at the moment is try to capture and reflect those factors. We don't claim to be a bioethics commission. We're not an ethical body I don't misquote me. I'm not saying we're not ethical, but we're not a body that whose prime function is to determine and resolve ethical issues per se. But I would argue that as a public body, it would be wrong of us, it would be remiss not to do our job and acknowledge that there's an enormous ethical dimension to it, and to inform ourselves as best we can about what the nature of those ethical questions are. I really believe if we didn't have an edge everywhere, you'd need to invent us. Society needs a mechanism, a way through which, a form of governance, through which it can address these issues. For every 5 ethicists, there are 6 opinions. For every 5 clinicians, there are 6 opinions. For every 5 administrators, there are some very tired people. That's what the HFEA does. That's how we try to strike a balance between trust and progress. I do apologise that I can't stay any longer than I can. I really enjoyed your tour. We've got about 10 minutes, I think, before 10:30, so I'm going to stop there, and I'd be happy to take questions and have a conversation, if you like, with Crystal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan, very much for that presentation. I have some electronic devices that should be able to help us in our discussions.
Can they balance ethics?
If I may give you one, thank Alan, you. And one to Rachel. If you'd like to take, say, 10 minutes, as Alan has already indicated, for questions, and then at 4:30 we'll break for tea and coffee. If you'd like to just state your name and the organisation that you're representing, just for the purposes of identification. Thank you very much. I think there's a question there from Professor Jones.
Thank you. Professor David Jones, I teach bioethics in St Mary's College, Twickenham. I was interested by your 20% figure, which I hadn't heard. But if it is around 20%, do you think it's problematic that 20% doesn't seem to be represented and doesn't seem ever to have been represented on the authority itself, on the people who make the decisions? Because I mean, there's a paragraph which I regard as rather sinister in the joint committee report, paragraph 47, I think it is. And it says, obviously people who have conscientious objection have no role in the implementation of the law. There has never been a Catholic on the HFEA.
Right, hello, nice to meet you. I'm a Catholic. No, that doesn't... I'm not a member of the authority. I mean, I think that... You're right, that bit of the Joint Select Committee who are well able to speak for themselves is one to give us pause for thought. Where there is a group, it's basically there are some people who genuinely believe we shouldn't use embryos ever for any purpose. And they are certainly a proportion of the population. Whether 20% is right, that's just a moray. How do you, if you're what you're attempting to do, is to reflect the range of opinion and considered view, how do you capture that in a public body? One way of doing it is having as representative a set of membership as you can. But you know, with 18 members, you're never gonna hit every single possibility. And I think it's part of our duty as officers, and we do try to reflect some of that in the work of the authority. And I have to tell you my experience, based on all of one meeting where we discussed a really complex issue of multiple births, which raises, really multiple embryo transfer. What we set out to do is reflect as much of that as we can and explain how it bears upon the decision they have to take. But some of it does come back to this issue of the tyranny of the majority and the tyranny of the minority. How do you know, in a democracy, in a society, in a functioning society, how do we resolve those issues? Because people feel so very strongly about them. I don't think that the authority, because it and I didn't know that it had never had a cat, has, if you like, ignored that aspect. Whether it's done enough to reflect it, I don't know enough.
We don't want people on it who are just going to say no, no, no. And it does seem to be that the way in which this minority, this minority who is unhappy about embryo fermentation, the way it's been dealt with is simply that it hasn't been represented on the authority.
Mm.
And given that the authority is not itself democratically, it's obviously in
Parliament. No, it isn't. Yes.
My views would be represented in Parliament because it's more democratic. But the HFPA is a body which is not democratic. And therefore, I think it's more incumbent upon it to have a range of opinions.
Yes.
And I think that's a problem, systematic problem with the authority.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're not democratic in the sense we don't have elected members on. I would argue we're democratic in that we're set up by direct act of Parliament. I mean, it all depends on where you believe democracy. But I do accept we're not. We don't have elected members on. Yes.
Okay. Because of time, we will press on. I think there's a gentleman at the end of the aisle there.
Thank you for the deft and humorous presentation there. I actually very much agree with the question that's just been raised, and just to point out that Baroness Warnock and that commission you referred to actually objected to Catholic members, and a lot of this has been exposed by Melanie Phillips, and she's written about it quite recently, actually. But just further to the point, do you think that the HFEA perhaps has, in its membership of the actual authority, something of a vested financial interest problem, in that a lot of the people who are on that, of course, being experts in the area, perhaps have some financial interest either in the research or in the reproductive side of things, or even in the discussion as a professor of law? I mean, do they not just have too much of an interest to be completely objective?
It's a long time since I did philosophy for a very short time at university, and objectivity is quite a discussion, isn't it, about subject. We're all subjective in one very real sense. I think that what my answer to that is that I've spent a lot of time on the HFEA is a classic British type of unelected public body, as primary care trusts and other health service bodies are. And my experience of the members or the non-executive members of those authorities is that they judge them by their behaviour. My experience is they bend over backwards to be open about any particular interest, personal interest that they might have. I'm not standing here saying there's an absolute guarantee that one or other of them might not be motivated by personal interest at some point, but one of the safeguards against that is we do have a membership that's very broadly spread, and they can and do challenge each other pretty effectively.
Okay.
So it's behaviour that counts. I don't know if there's a perfect system that, if you exclude every single interest, you end up with some pretty bland people.
Okay, thank you.
By law, we have to. And of course, administratively, we don't appoint our own members. That's done by the NHS Appointments Commission.
Thank you. Did Professor Raymond Sauter, do you have a question? Do I hear your see your hand?
This lady, no? This lady here.
Okay.
This lady, yes.
Jennifer Swift, freelance writer. My question is about ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, which is, we don't know exactly how rare condition, but it's potentially life-threatening when women donate eggs. And I understand the HFEA is going to gather much better statistics on this in the future. And I'm wondering how you're going to report those statistics, whether you're going to break them down as to clinic, so that potential patients can be aware of this complication in their treatment.
I have absolutely no idea what do you think?
I'm not
I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to in terms of ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, because it's something that the professional bodies respond to. It's something that, as a regulator, we provide very clear information for patients about ovarian hyperstimulation, what the risks are, and we require clinics to have a certain protocol in place so that patients know exactly what to do if they experience certain symptoms. But ultimately, in the treatment of ovarian hyperstimulation, which is something which is linked to drug treatments, which is not within the HFEA's remit, it's very much a clinical matter, and it's something that the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists and the British Fertility Society would have a clear view on. Alan, I don't know if that covers what you'd like to say about that.
In other words, we don't regulate individual clinical practice. But what you're getting at is, to the extent that we have data, and it is relevant to the choices that patients make and to driving improvement, we should use the data to do that. That would be, now, I don't know enough about ovarian hyperstimulation to give you a specific answer, but if the thrust behind your question is using the data we collect to contribute to improving the safety and quality of services and helping patients make better informed choices, yes, that's what we should do.
One final question from my colleague, because it's all worth my job.
Rachel from the BioCentre.
Hello.
I was interested by your comments about the HFEA and whether it is or is not an ethical body, and wondering where on the balance between an ethical deliberator and a body that simply measures and then makes policy according to the democratic median. Mm. Where on that spectrum do you see the HFEA?
I think we're ethical in the sense we set ourselves high standards of personal and organisational behaviour. I don't think that the HFEA was set up as a sort of ethics commission to look at ethics exclusively. What we've been asked to do, what we're charged with Parliament by doing, is regulating, largely through the means of the issuing of licences, the circumstances in which patients can access IVF and other forms of treatment. So we license treatment, storage and research, and we use the code of practice which underpins those licences to set the quality and safety standards. When we come to make policy decisions about complex and difficult areas like hybrid research or multiple births, for us to do our job, my point is for us to address those questions and not take into account the fact that there is an ethical dimension that lots of people have views on, and to try to be clear about what the ethical aspects of any particular decision are, would be wrong. But what you try to do is take a decision in the round, but we don't set ourselves up as an arbiter of ethics per se. We attempt to make pragmatic administrative decisions that allow a balance between trust and progress.
Well, we're going to draw stumps here because Alan Doran needs to leave in a few minutes. I do want to thank him very warmly. I think this has been a wonderful whetting of appetites for what will be a great national debate in the coming months as the Parliament turns again to business from almost 20 years ago. And this, I'm sure, will stimulate our thinking, as, of course, is our comparative discussion, where we look at, one of my hopes is that there will be a lot more focus on what other countries are doing in this area in the context of the British public debate, so people are more aware of what the policy options are. And I also, before I formally thank Alan Doran, want to apologise to you. I do not know why the Royal Society of Medicine has decided to try and freeze us all to death this afternoon. It may be some new report came out showing that coal people live longer or something like that. But we will see what we can do to remedy that as you put your scarves around your necks during the tea break. But we will have tea to warm you up, and for those who endure until the end at 6 o'clock, we will have wine to warm you up. So we are concerned to refresh you. But I want to thank Alan Doran very much for a wonderful presentation this afternoon. Thank you very much. And now we break for a few minutes for tea.